Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Head to patreon.com/chasingEarhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
A U.S. Treasury agent for 30 years, Les Kinney once worked as a liaison to the CIA and the Pentagon. Since retiring, he's used his intelligence skills to scour the records of government agencies, looking for evidence that the government knew more than they admitted. He has uncovered previously unknown documents, including what he believes is photographic evidence of Earhart after she disappeared. This may be the lost evidence that finally solves the case.
I've spent pretty much the last 10 years of my life researching the Earhart mystery because there's been so much disinformation put out there.
Les Kinney has been researching the Amelia Earhart case for over a decade. Part of what is now known as our original 25, Les has been on the Chasing Earhart radar equally as long. After finding what is now known in the public as the Jaluit Dock photo in the National Archives, Les has become the go-to investigator and is at the center of the whirlwind that is known as the Japanese Capture Hypothesis. Tonight, on the 55th episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, Les makes his debut as a project guest via Zoom from Seattle to break down and discuss Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan in the Marshall Islands, his personal thoughts on the Nikumaroro bones and the post-loss radio messages, his investigative work on one of the most important missing persons cases of all time, and why the United States government may know much more about the fate of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan than anyone ever thought possible. The guest I have with me tonight is someone that I've personally been waiting to have on the show for a very long time. Anyone who follows the project knows about the original 25, and this was the list that I put together over a decade ago of folks that I wanted to be part of Chasing Earhart. And every time our team brings on one of those original 25, it's a very good day. The gentleman that I have here with me tonight was at the center of last year's Lost Evidence Project, and he's been researching the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan for a very, very long time. I've been waiting to say this for a while now, but Les Kinney, welcome to Chasing Earhart, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, as always, Les, before we dive in, let's get some housekeeping out of the way. Can you tell everyone about your education and your professional background, please?
Well, I'm from the state of Michigan and grew up in the Detroit area, and parents originally from the Upper Peninsula. I attended Western Michigan University, graduated from there, and shortly thereafter, I joined I was employed by the Office of Naval Intelligence just about the time that they were transitioning over to the name of the Naval Investigative Service. So I was with them for about 4 years, and at that point, I decided to look elsewhere and became a Treasury agent with the U.S. Customs. It was at that time, it was called U.S. Customs Office of Investigation or Agency Service. It was one of the four Treasury agencies that have Treasury agents. And so I was with them the remainder of my career and retired from them and worked in Washington, D.C. for a number of years as a branch chief and temporary division director, as a liaison to the Congress there for a while, the State Department, the Central Intelligence Agency, that sort of thing. And eventually, I worked in the field in various locations. I was the agent in charge of the Denver region, the agent in charge of the Hawaii, Honolulu region, and Seattle for a while, Blaine, Washington, and pretty much worked everywhere in the United States and most places around the world.
And now for a two-part question. This is something I ask of every guest that's ever sat down on the show with us. What are your earliest recollections of Amelia Earhart, and how did she come into your life professionally?
Yeah, it's something that I do recall quite well, and it had something to do with when I was working with the Office of Naval Intelligence in Chicago. And at that time, one of the assistant supervisors, the assistant special agent in charge, was a gentleman that was a part of the Earhart mystery, or I guess you'd call it that. And I had just read a book that had come out two or three years earlier by Fred Goiner, The Search for Amelia Earhart. I believe the book was published around 66. I think I read it maybe 69 or 1970. And I'm wandering through the office. I was just a young agent at that time, and I noticed my boss was holding court, so to speak, over several agents in his office. And somehow the discussion of Earhart come up, and they're all holding their coffee cups, and I was listening. I didn't say much. And all of a sudden, he talked about Earhart, and I had just read this book by Fred Goiner, and I was intrigued by that sort of thing anyway. And after whatever they were saying, and I don't recall what they were saying about Earhart, I asked him, I said, I don't quite understand if the Navy's official position was that she crashed and sank or whatever, why you would have gone to Saipan on an investigation. And who ordered the investigation? I guess I was a little bit blunt or outspoken. And he kind of looked at me and like, you know, why are you asking me that? Or, you know, you probably shouldn't ask that question. I'm not quite sure. But whatever it was, I knew that at that point in time, there was something else involved with the Earhart mystery. And maybe Fred Goiner had something going. That's how I got my start.
All right. So now before we get into the matter at hand, which is why we're here tonight, let me ask you something just very straightforward. How did Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan end up in the Marshall Islands? Can you walk us through what happened on the morning of July 2nd, 1937?
Well, sure. And as you well know, there are different groups and organizations that have tried to track what happened to Amelia Earhart. And they don't agree with what I'm about to say. Because of the fact that I'm an investigator and I look at things in a little bit different perspective than maybe an average researcher, and I consider myself a decent researcher as well, the fact that there were so many witnesses associated with the Earhart mystery that seemed to originate out of the Marshall Islands, there had to be some truth to it. At least that's what I thought. And so I started focusing years ago after I retired full-time, so to speak, investigating this thing and coming to the conclusion that there's no question that Earhart had gone down in the Marshall Islands. And I believe those early Marshallese witnesses, the fact that they didn't know each other, they might have been from islands that were hundreds of miles apart, and they all come up with basically the same story. I put a lot of credence into what they said. There was just no reason to lie. And beyond that, you know, the Earhart mystery started developing in the Marshall Islands a long, long time ago. In fact, it was just almost immediately after the U.S. invasion of the Marshalls at Melia Atoll and Jolliet and some of the other places there that reports come trickling in early 1944 about potential witnesses that heard about this American woman who had gone down in a plane somewhere in the Marshall Islands. And that was perpetuated and continued through the rest of the war. The Navy and the U.S. government really said nothing about it, but it did hit the papers and the press, and it had a lot of credibility. And so the embryonic stages of Earhart being in the Marshall Islands originated literally during the war with press releases, little blips that came into the U.S. press. And so that's how I got my start. And I felt very strongly that she had landed there. And of course, as you know, back, I believe, in around 2012 or 13, Dick Spink, another researcher that was a teacher not too far from where I live here in the state of Washington, went to Melia Atoll and found these artifacts. And I was quite intrigued by what he had found because the location was exactly where I felt that Earhart had gone down. Prior to that, I heard about this guy, Spink, but I didn't believe anything that was told to me. Until I found out that the island, that this little tiny island that he found these artifacts might have something to do with Earhart, because it was the same area that I had focused on.
What's interesting, Les, is you've been working at this obviously for a very, very long time ago. We touched on that in the opening of the show. But what I found interesting lately is sort of the back and forth between yourself and the folks over at Tiger, which is, you know, if they followed our show, they've heard some of the guests from Tiger on our show. But what I found to be especially interesting is how this all works. And for those that don't know, Tiger will put out a press release and a report, as they did with the Dr. Jantz paper earlier, and which we'll get to, of course, and more recently on Amelia's birthday with the post-loss radio report. And then a couple of days later, you will put out a rebuttal piece to said report. Can you tell me about that process and what that's been like for you as far as, you know, listening to what they put out and then putting out your response to those reports?
Well, first of all, Tiger has an alternate premise. And of course, that premise is that Earhart had and Noonan had gone down on this island, Nicomoro, formerly called Gardner Island, several hundred miles southeast of her landing place on Howland Island. And they base that premise entirely on a few post-loss radio messages where allegedly some Pan Am radio operators out in Midway and Wake Island triangulated, so to speak, and said that this might have been the area. And there were some vague references on a couple radio messages that were received by people back in the United States, a couple that said she had gone down in this area. And for some reason, Rick Gillespie and Tiger focused in on this theory that she had gone on Nick Morrow. And I never believed it from the very beginning, because it seemed, well, frankly, too preposterous. And don't get me wrong, Tiger has done some great work. Some of the scientific analysis and radio analysis that they've done, it's been outstanding. It's top class. And I don't hesitate at all to look at their findings and make a determination of whether I think the work that they've completed is good or not. Beyond the fact that they found some radio waves that they thought emitted from this area, everything that they have done doesn't seem to possibly lead me in any way to believe that she had gone down at that location. When they make a claim, they tout it in the press. They have a publicist involved with them that they obviously pay a substantial amount of money. And so then they work on whatever discovery that they believe that the public would possibly buy into. And this goes back for 20, 25, 30 years. And then all of a sudden it fades off in the distance until they find another new theory or some sort of belief that can be published. And then they go on with that. And so recently I decided, I'm going to put out a rebuttal, because there really is nobody else attempting to disprove some of the theories that they've espoused. And so consequently, I decided to do that. The first one, of course, was with these bones that were supposedly examined and found in 1940, but disappeared in 1941 by the British. And Tiger is utilizing, or has utilized, that one to indicate that through one of their anthropologists at the University of Tennessee, a retired gentleman by the name of Dr. Richard Jantz, that with 99% certainty, the bones found in Nick Morrow belonged to that of Earhart. Well, that's just crazy talk. And so I wrote a paper rebutting that, which we can get into if you'd like. And then just recently, there's another one relative to his post-loss radio messages that I felt very strongly had to be challenged. And I did that by writing a paper regarding a woman from Ashland, Kentucky, that actually heard Earhart, and who is the only one that offered and gave a location where Earhart had, and Noonan had landed. And of course, her name was Nina Paxton. We could go on and on about that, but the Hoodless Bones claims are something that just any reasonable person should think that it would be impossible to come up with 99% accuracy bones that were found on that little island, in which, in fact, two British doctors already had indicated when they found those bones more than likely belonged to an Asian or a Polynesian male, probably in his late to mid 40s or 50s, and that the bones had been there for many, many years, and they kind of insinuated the bones might have been there for maybe 75 to 100 years or more. The Tiger organization decided to prove that those bones belonged to Earhart. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And in order to come up with this conclusion, they had Dr. Jantz, who has been associated with Tiger for well over 10 years, show that the bones, through some computer analysis and et cetera, could have been Earhart. And how they did that was this. Since they didn't have the bones, and they've been missing since 1941, they decided to find a piece of clothing that had been donated to the Purdue Archives, and it's a piece of a pair of Amelia's slacks, or one pair. So Dr. Jantz called them up and asked them for measurements on clothing, and they come up with this pair of slacks, and a woman actually on the phone goes and measured these, probably with a tape measure, and she said, oh, the inseam is such and such. And so therefore, they utilized the basis of slacks to come up with the bones that were found at the lower torso of the body, and said, lo and behold, they're almost identical to the slack inseam length of Amelia's pants. And so therefore, they reach this crazy conclusion that the bones belong to Amelia Earhart. It's preposterous. It just makes no sense. First thing, I just don't quite understand, and I'm sure any woman will tell you that you don't necessarily buy the same pair of pants over and over again with the same inseam. Styles change. Pants might be an inch or two shorter, longer, and et cetera. And to reach that conclusion is crazy. So I wrote a paper rebutting the Tiger Hoodless Bones claims. And for the most part, the reason why it couldn't be under any circumstances is the fact that Amelia Earhart, on two occasions, had a very, very, I should say, traumatic surgery or operation where she had what they call a Caldwell Luck procedure. And this is an awful procedure where she had her upper jaw drilled through her mouth, through the back of the mouth on one side and then the other, to relieve tension from a bacterial infection that was chronic in her nasal passages. And it creates a hole about the size of a dime. And she had this done twice, once in, I think, 1926, and she had it done again in late June of 1935. And the skull that they found in Nicomoro in 1940, the British two doctors that examined it, had no evidence of this Caldwell Luck procedure. And as I wrote on this paper, the Hoodless Bones paper, I indicated that a five-year-old would have seen that immediately. Well, Tiger comes back and said, well, maybe a portion of that jaw was missing because it appeared to be on one side where the part of the lower jaw was missing. Well, it might be true, but according to some people, including one of Tiger's own physicians that was on their forum years ago, said it very well probably should have been there anyway. Regardless, there was a procedure on the other side of the jaw, and there's no evidence of any part of that skull being, the cranium being missing over there. It just makes no sense whatsoever. And to tout that as being with 99% certainty that the bones belong to Earhart is just pure poppycock.
This most recent post-loss report by Tiger promoted you to introduce someone to the general public that hasn't been widely known in the past. And you mentioned her name earlier, but I'm talking about the other post-loss radio signal. So at this point, can you please introduce everyone to Nina Paxton?
Yes. Nina Paxton was a woman living in Ashland, Kentucky in 1937. And she was educated. She was a registered nurse. She had gone through nursing school, 3 years of college. She had a great reputation as far as professional concern. Her reputation was beyond repute. And she was listening to her radio that Saturday afternoon on July 3rd, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And apparently she was puttering and was taking care of a five-year-old son. And all of a sudden out of the radio blurted the voice of Amelia Earhart. She was embarrassed later on when she reported this. Well, she heard about 300 or 400 words. And she actually wrote down on some rough notes or a piece of scratch paper, as she describes it, some of the words that Amelia was speaking. She heard Amelia for a few minutes, and she said the voice was strong and clear. After she heard her and remembered what she had heard and wrote and had these notes of hers, she went to the local police department. She called them up. And she also called the local Coast Guard station. She said, I just heard Amelia Earhart. And they must have asked her a few questions, and she told them the call numbers that she heard preceding the SOS message from Earhart. And the call numbers were KHABQ, KHAB call, and this is Amelia Earhart, and et cetera. And they said, they laughed at her. And they said, no, you must have heard something entirely different or whatever, because that is not Amelia Earhart's airplane call signals. That's KHAQQ. Nina Paxton then put this aside for a while and didn't do anything about it. And eventually, about a week later, she told the local newspaper about it. And they put a little blurb in the newspaper about an Ashland lady hears Earhart. And she indicated in that she heard them, and that this Noonan was injured, and the fact that they went down somewhere and the wind was blowing. But she did not give a location. And I believe that was the case simply because the reporter was probably a little short with her, and the little report that he wrote in the ditty in that paper doesn't say much at all and kind of blew her off. At that point, Nina Paxton felt a little embarrassed, and she didn't do much about it for another day or two. Then she started writing letters. And she wrote to George Putnam, and she wrote to Walter Winchell, and she wrote to her congressman by the name of Vinson, and a bunch of other people almost immediately, with all through late July and into August. And she said, I heard Amelia Earhart, and she told the exact location. She said Earhart had gone down in the Marshall Islands, and more specifically, she indicated a latitude and longitude location, which is very close to Amelia Toll. Unfortunately, the original little scratch note that Nina had described in a letter to George Putnam and to a couple other people doesn't exist. It no longer exists. When I found these Nina Paxton papers at this little obscure college in the mountains of North Carolina, it wasn't there. There was several hundred pieces of paper there that Nina had wrote trying to convince people that she had heard Earhart. And she went on to describe, for instance, the injuries to Noonan, the fact that the plane was damaged, and they're on this small middle island of grouping of three. And it goes on and on and on. But it's very strong evidence that she had heard, simply because nobody else would have known, for instance, she wouldn't have known that the call sign was not KHABQ, which was Amelia's call sign from her previous airplane, the Vega, which she had sold about a year and a half earlier. So Nina Paxton was confused about this, and she went on to say, I don't understand why people don't believe that the plane call sign was KHABQ. And nobody told her. And she wouldn't have known that, ever. And no matter what anybody might say, that, oh, she could have looked it up in the papers. So I've done quite an amount of research into that. And I've only found a couple locations where the call sign of that plane was in a newspaper from 2 or 3 years earlier, and it certainly wasn't in the local Ashland paper. And for her to know that it just does not seem plausible at all. She just would not have known the aircraft. So there's no question in my mind that Nina Paxton heard, in fact, Amelia Earhart on that day. And there's no reason for her to lie, none whatsoever. She is the only one of the 56 or 57 post-loss radio messages that people might believe emanated from Earhart that actually gives a location. And not only does it give a location in the Marshall Islands, she indicated the fact that it was at Mealy Atoll. A little later on, she starts trying to think about more of the words, and she tried to put these 300 words or 400 words that she heard into even a proper chronological order, and which she did do. I can't give her that much credence to believe that some of the later memories that she might have had were accurate. They very well could be, and more than likely they are. But I give credence to the verbiage that she utilized in that first 3-4 weeks after she heard those messages and she put them down on paper. So it's very, very convincing. And of course, it goes exactly against the beliefs of the Tiger Group. And they tout a radio message of a young girl and a 15-year-old down in St. Petersburg, Florida, by the name of Betty Klink, as being reliable and credible. And yet they now decided, oh, after I wrote these Nina Paxton papers, that Nina is no longer credible. And they utilize such ruses as, oh, the message that Nina heard, she describes the injuries to the captain. And Tiger has indicated, for instance, oh, Earhart never called Fred Noonan captain. They called him Freddie or Noonan, but there's no indication in any press reports that Earhart had ever called Noonan captain. And so therefore, Nina Paxton cannot be credible. Well, that's just crazy. And so I went and did a little bit more research, and I found at least 4 to possibly 6 first-person accounts where Amelia Earhart is called Noonan captain, preceding his name, Captain Noonan or whatever it may be. So she indeed did know the fact that Noonan was a captain, and she utilized that in her vernacular at the time. It's the only one that can be credible, and of course it leads directly to the Marshall Islands, which lends more evidence that Earhart and Noonan had gone down not only in the Marshall Islands, but at Mealy Atoll.
Now, Les, you mentioned earlier you dropped the number of 57. There were 57 post-loss messages. Can you talk a little bit about just that general consensus of those post-loss messages, what those mean? Were they allegedly, they were allegedly sent by Amelia, but were they from Amelia? How does Nina figure into
the post-loss radio message report, the Tiger release. Can you kind of sum it all up for everybody?
Sure. That's a good question, by the way. There is a an argument that Earhart and Noonan could not have transmitted any post-loss radio messages because of the fact that if the plane went down and there wasn't an engine running, she couldn't transmit. And of course, the general consensus as a whole was that she went down in the ocean, and so therefore, obviously, she couldn't transmit. There were many, many messages that were sent out and emanated from the Pacific literally right after Earhart and Noonan had gone down. And of course, she used two radio frequencies, and those radio frequencies, 3105 and I think 3105 and 6210 daytime and nighttime frequencies. And they were picked up almost immediately after she had gone down at certain times. And the times that the radio transmissions were heard were about the time of low tide. And this is where Tiger's got it spot on. There's no question about that. And I believe that too. I believe that she sent out post-loss radio messages. There was a Honolulu radio station, for instance, that sent out a general signal that said, Amelia Earhart, if you can hear us, would you come back with four dashers on the radio? And lo and behold, right away from the Pacific is four dashers on the radio. She was transmitting on a frequency that is not common and was used basically for aircraft radio messages within the United States and to a certain degree in Canada. The radios at that time did not have crystals where the average radio ham would have been able to fake these messages, and that's been kind of overlooked. Tiger brings that up, and I think they've done I think they're accurate with that. And so therefore, there could not be a lot of phony messages heard around the United States or possibly in the Pacific simply because nobody would have had the capability to transmit on those frequencies. Naturally, you could transmit on some other frequency and there might have been a harmonic where they could heard it. But I don't believe there was that many phony radio distress calls that received that were not Earhart actually transmitting them. It was her. And Pan Am had listening stations in Wake and Midway Island because of the new Pan Am bases there. And of course, Honolulu had several radios tuned into the Pacific. And of course, on the Itasca that was looking for Earhart, they were listening 24 hours a day for a while. And a few other ships out there, one was out of New Zealand and another American ship. And they all heard these messages, and a lot of them heard them simultaneously, which meant that they were transmitted by a single transmitter and at a certain time. And when they were logged, it just appears very strongly that Earhart was transmitting for probably, I'm saying, 3 to 4 days trying to get help and assistance. And there were people that heard her. And unfortunately, most of the time, what they heard was nothing but garble. There's a few instances where people had heard one or two words or three words, and then it would go into static. Nina Paxton heard 300 or 400 words on some sort of an anomaly. That area in Nashville in Kentucky, for instance, it's right on the Ohio River. It's in kind of a bowl. And when I went down there to do some investigation to try to find out about the Nina Paxton papers in the first place, I was told by several people that years ago, not so much today because of radio interference, but it's a bowl that's like a satellite dish, and it's a collective dish that where these signals bouncing off the ionosphere have a tendency to be picked up by local radio, and she just happened to pick it up. I lend great credence to those post-loss radio messages, and I believe very strongly that they did emanate from Earhart and Noonan. There's a few more that were sent and picked up by a couple of radio hams who knew Earhart in Los Angeles that Tiger disputes and said that these guys were phony. I don't believe that. I think that they actually heard portions of the radio messages as well. Unfortunately, later on in life, one of those two gentlemen started elaborating and embellishing what he heard 40 years earlier. So, you know, his later accounts are not credible. That doesn't mean to say that prior to him getting Alzheimer's, what he had wrote and what was reported in the press were not accurate back in the mid-1930s.
Les, you've been talking a lot about, you know, researching and vetting and going through processes that you go through, that you've been doing this for a long time. We have a lot of young folks that are like in the teens, early 20s that want to do this type of work in their career. I wonder if you could just sort of point those folks in the right direction. Can you tell everybody how it is you research your data, how you vet everything? What makes something viable to Les Kinney when you're researching something when it comes to Earhart?
That's another great question. Well, first of all, I have a background as an investigator, and I'm kind of analytical, and I utilize kind of a methodology where could this have happened, or is this beyond belief? That will make me go to the next step. In the case of Earhart, and I can, it's a little different than doing a normal criminal investigation, which I've done hundreds of, and civil investigations as well. But if you have a variety of individuals or people that tell you something occurred, then you have to believe where that old adage, where there's smoke, there's fire. And consequently, you cannot dispute 15, 20, 30, 40 people that have the same general information if they're firsthand witnesses. And of course, this is what you do as an investigator in general. If you find one or two witnesses, you try to figure out whether, in fact, they have any reason to embellish or lie, or if they have any motive. And as far as the Earhart, and I can only relate it to Earhart, not as a general investigator, there's just too many people out there that have heard her or saw her or saw her airplane, or read a report from the United States government that no longer exists or has been shredded or destroyed or is still classified. They saw in these things, and you have to believe they were probably true. They would not all lie, especially for people who didn't know each other. If people are separated by oceans and they're carrying out the same message, if one person's on one island, for instance, in the Marshall, and you'd never heard of another island 400 miles away, but they come out with the same type of information, then you have to give a lot of credence to it. And of course, that goes on to the witnesses later on regarding Earhart being in Saipan as well. Then I would just, I doggedly go and look for records and to find out whether those records exist. And I've spent several hundred hours at the various national archives and holdings that might have some Earhart material. And as far as the U.S. government's national archives is concerned, everything that seemed to hone in on the time that Earhart had landed somewhere or would disappeared in the Marshalls or wherever you might want to say, the U.S. government is silent about it. And other than the original search reports, for instance, the Navy had listening stations, these cryptographic stations, all over the Pacific at that time. And they would have heard Earhart. There's no question about that. They were stationed in Agana, Guam. They were stationed in the Philippines. And they had listening stations in Hawaii and in Hong Kong. And more than likely, knowing that she was on that flight, they would have been listening for her. Now, that wasn't their reason for there. They were listening for Japanese radio messages for intelligence purposes. But all of that material from the various listening stations, which is a Navy group called OP-20G, they're missing. They flat are missing from the files from 1937 through early 1938. And then they'll pick up again, and they're available again. And they were available before this time. So it makes me believe that the government probably withholding that kind of material. And of course, that just makes me grit my teeth and to look a little bit further and harder, mainly looking for mistakes in the National Archives. So, you know, I plottedly try to look at each individual lead and to lend credibility to it to see if it is credible. And if not, I'll throw it away and move on to the next one. And that's what I've done with this Earhart research.
Les, you just mentioned earlier, as you were speaking about government documentation, it's either been destroyed or shredded, or it still remains classified. What I wanted to ask you since, well, forever now, is if this, let's say hypothetically speaking that tomorrow, all the records, all the Earhart records are unsealed and they're put out there and the full story is put out for the general public, what do you think happens? What is the next step if it's turned out to be the case that she was indeed in the custody of the Japanese, she was executed by the Japanese, she was met a horrible end? What do you think that does to the legacy of not only Amelia Earhart but maybe FDR?
Well, I don't think it does much for the legacy of Earhart. I think that all along, I'm going to answer your last part of your question first. Earhart probably thought, and this is I'm only surmising, is that when she crash landed in the Marshall Islands, she thought that after she was picked up by the Japanese, until it's disproven, that picture that I found in the archives relative to the Jaluyot photo picture, so to speak, with the dock scene, she was relaxed there. And there was very little military presence in the Marshall Islands at that time. And I felt that she probably thought that she was eventually, within a few weeks, would find her way back to the United States. Of course, that's not the case. But as far as the cover-up, so to speak, by the FDR, this is hard to say. It's a long, I could give you a long, lengthy answer, but there's two rationales behind it. If Amelia Earhart was on some sort of a gray spy mission, or what they call a white spy mission, wherein somebody said, just go take a look, see, and see if there's something over there that's worthwhile for us. And if you see that, just make sure you report it. Well, that was basically the kind of thing that Franklin Delano Roosevelt did routinely. He was an amateur intelligence agent, spy, what have you. He was involved with a group of men back in his early life that met secretly, and they wrote code, and he just enjoyed the heck out of that sort of thing. And it carried through into his presidency, and there are numerous examples where he has asked people privately to conduct intelligence probes for him, but not through official channels. Could that have happened with Amelia Earhart? Yes, it could have. Would it have been something extensive? No. I think it would have been something as simple as, if you fly heading to Holland, could you deviate and head over towards the Marshall Islands or Truk Lagoon to see if you see any large ships there or anything? And she wasn't flying that high. And the idea of her being involved in a formal spy mission with cameras attached to the bottom of the plane, I don't believe any of that. I think it would probably be something very, very quick and easy, and where she would report back at a later date to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who she knew, by the way, very, very well. Now, the second part of that, and I know this is lengthy, but the second part of that is this. Let's say she had nothing to do with spying whatsoever. What happened at that time and what was going on in the Pacific in 1937 is the United States was at an unofficial war, so to speak, an intelligence war with Japan. Japan was our enemy in 1937. There's no question about that. And if you read history and if you do the probes and the research, you will see that we were having war games where the Japanese were always the enemy. And the games were called Orange. And the Japanese were doing the same, by the way. There was a tremendous amount of resentment by the Japanese against the United States government for a variety of reasons, and some were righteous reasons. And we were very wary of what the Japanese were doing in the Mandated Islands, or what we'd call mostly Micronesia today. We didn't know, and we tried to send probes there. And they were basically all unsuccessful. So Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the U.S. Navy in general were very, very curious to what was happening in the Pacific. And because we thought even in 1937, there might be a war with Japan, we certainly weren't ready for that war. So with Earhart, if she went down, and the Japanese would have instinctively thought that she was a spy, because that's just the makeup of the demeanor of the Japanese military at that time. They then would, if they would have found the camera, which she very well could have had pictures that she took, because she certainly was carrying, I believe, two cameras, they would have been hesitant to release her, especially with the fact that if she went down Amelia Atoll and there were some indications that they were just completing a seaplane base there, not the military base, the big airfield that was on Mili Mili, but preceding that. And they would have been paranoid. And there might have been some sort of order from the Japanese military in Tokyo to do not release this person, because they will clearly indicate that we've been fortifying the Mandated Islands. The United States government, probably FDR and the Navy and the Army for that matter, probably knew that Earhart was captured by the Japanese within a week to 2 weeks after she went missing. What are you going to do about that? Are you going to challenge the Japanese? Are you going to ask them, do you have Amelia Earhart? And they're going to say no. And if the United States government says, we know you have her, and we know that because we have captured your radio transmissions, and we know after decoding those transmissions that you have her, we want her back. Well, of course, the United States government is not going to do that, because those codes that we had deciphered from the Japanese were very valuable, and it takes years to break those codes, and we weren't about to do that. So Earhart would have become expendable. And the only way we would have been able to get her back would have been a challenge to Japanese and say, we know you have her. And the Japanese would have declined to acknowledge that. And you'd have a potentiality for a war, something that we weren't ready for in 1937. We obviously weren't ready for it in December 1941. So the situation was tenuous out there, and there's just no way that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, one, whether he actually asked her to do this mission, and of course that would have possibly impacted his presidential campaign the next time around, or it definitely would have caused him to maybe lose that election in 1940. We don't know. She became expendable, and Fred Noonan became expendable, and that's how the situation happened. Now, today, those records still might be classified simply because of the fact that Japan is our closest ally in Asia, and we need Japan very badly because of the situation that is unfolding in North Korea and the way that North Korea is venting. We have bases in Korea, and the Japanese want us there, and they're a buffer, and they're very much an ally where we need their support. And I can't imagine if the Japanese government said, look, we did something bad to Amelia Earhart, but for God's sakes, you can't tell anybody. If there was those kind of meetings that had taken place in the foreign ministry in Japan with U.S. State Department representatives, the United States is going to honor that request. And even if that wasn't said, and I don't believe it was, I'm just using that as an example, the Japanese would be thoroughly embarrassed if they had to admit to the world that they not only captured Amelia Earhart, but were responsible for she and Fred Noonan's death. That is something that they would not do. They are still denying, for instance, much of the atrocities that occurred in Nanking in 1937 and 38. They deny the units, the 777 units that were doing operations on American prisoners of war, you know, just to see what was going on and putting all sorts of bacteria in them, along with a lot of other prisoners in that era. They're denying all of that, and they continue to deny that. And they teach revisionist history still in their schools. So it seems that Japan would never admit to their role in the capture of Amelia Earhart. And so those records are gone, and you're not going to find them. The records that the United States government has, they're not necessarily in one single file folder the way people might envision. There might be a few records here. They might be records in the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, which, by the way, maintains the cryptographic material still from World War II. There might be papers that are still top secret from the FDR library that you're not releasing. So it's kind of a hodgepodge of material that would tell us that Earhart would have been captured by the Japanese. It's certainly not all in one place. And I doubt very seriously whether any of the current leaders in our government, military or civilian, have any idea whatsoever what's going on with the Earhart papers or material that would let us know that she was captured by the Japanese.
Tonight, we've just scratched the surface on your research into this case, but before we wrap up, I'd like to ask you something that I've asked every single person that's ever appeared on this show. Chasing Earhart is, above all, about impact and legacy, and I'd like to get your thoughts now on what you believe to be Amelia Earhart's legacy to the world, and why, in your opinion, does everyone care so much about the fate of her and Fred Noonan after all these years?
Well, there's two things. One, I am, as you know, Chris, I'm trying to write a book regarding the mystery of Amelia Earhart. But it's not only the mystery of Amelia Earhart, but it's a biography as well. And I found some information relative to Amelia and her life and Fred Noonan and his life that have never been published before. She had a great legacy. I think that Amelia's best legacy and most outstanding contribution is the movement where she told and continued to tell until the time that she disappeared, that women were liberated and that they could do anything they wanted to do, and please don't let the current cultural standards of the day stop you. She was in the forefront of the women's movement in a very quiet, subtle, feminine way to tell women that they were the equal of men and they had every bit as right to pursue their dreams as well as a man. I personally think that is her biggest legacy, and she strongly believed in it. She had a few skeletons in her closet, but everybody does. And you cannot take away the tremendous contributions that she gave, especially young women and women of the day, to go out and pursue your dreams. And she opened the doors, even then, to women hiring. She made corporation and businesses uneasy about discriminating against women as far as wages are concerned, way, way, way ahead of her time. The other thing regarding Earhart, that not quite a legacy, but this was a brilliant woman. There's no question about that. I mean, she had her faults. There's no question about that as well. But here's a woman, you know, that basically could play the banjo. She was a pianist. She actually was a very decent singer. Most people don't realize that. She was athletic. And she spoke not only is German, which is her background, she was fluent in French. She could speak Spanish. And she just had uncanny abilities. She was way ahead of her time. And she left a very strong legacy. And hopefully, maybe I can say some of those things in the book.
Yes. And you've mentioned a touch on the book a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit more about that book and when we can expect that to be released?
I'm probably about halfway to three quarters through the book. And what I've done is a lot of it's what the explanation I just give you. I probably spent way too much time on her, on the biography of Amelia Earhart and her background versus the mystery itself. But I wanted to put that out there because there are three major biographies and they're all kind of dated now, of course, regarding Earhart. And they're all credible. They're all very good. One is much better than the other. I strongly recommend anybody endorse this rich book. Amelia Earhart is by far the best. The book hopefully will be done next, maybe within the next 6-8 months. Research, unfortunately, is getting in the way. I'm constantly doing research and I deviate from actually writing the book, but I'm about halfway through and I'm trying to make it so that it's a readable book of interest. It's got kind of a nonfiction that is casual, but will tell a complete story.
Les, thank you so much for joining me on the show tonight. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me, Chris.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Japanese Capture retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Incorporated. Chris Evan Films, Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.